Robert Coover with Michael Silverblatt, recorded at the Lenzic Theater in Santa Fe, New Mexico, on October 11th, 2006.
I hope you'll forgive me the cheesiness of telling you that you're my favorite audience in the world. I had a friend who was just here in Santa Fe 2 weeks ago, and he happened to mention my name, that he knew me at a dinner, and people, you know, said, "You really do? What's he really like?" But you know what I'm like. I mean, I'm like what I am right here. I wanted to let you know that many people ask, now all 17 years of that show that you hear here, Bookworm, is on the KCRW website, so you can hear any of the over nearly 1,000 interviews I've been doing, and you know I'm very proud to have them available to everyone. Thank you. Now, Robert Coover, let me tell you a sad and amazing story. Once upon a time, the best American literature was being celebrated by the critics, by the book reviews. This no longer happens. This was a window of around 15 years, and strangely, can you hear me? Good. Yes? No? I just want to be sure, because when Robert Coover comes out, we don't want any problems. Strangely, Nabokov, Borges, Beckett introduced the possibility in America of a real literature. We had had some, Melville, Faulkner, but by and large, American literature had been the story of fathers going fishing with sons. It's not enough. It's an insufficient literature. Suddenly, there were, and I'll try to name them in order, John Hawkes, John Barth, Thomas Pynchon, Robert Coover, Donald Barthelme, Don DeLillo. And these writers got the attention that they had deserved. This is an unusual thing. Do you understand? It's not common in America. We're back, you know, now to celebrating Chick Lit and all kinds of books that don't deserve the mention, while the best books being published you'll hardly have heard of at all. A real reader in America right now needs to be an explorer and an adventurer. This is good on the one hand. It allows you to develop and discover your own tastes. It requires that you, as I've been recently saying, support the efforts of altruistic publishers. And I want to remind you that without altruism, there is no culture. Which is why that I'm particularly happy to be associated with the Lannan Foundation, true altruists, and that the Lannan Foundation has given awards to these writers, to Robert Coover, to William H. Gass, to John Hawkes, to John Barth. This is a very, very important thing, especially right now. Now, Coover comes along with the recognition that stories are not just told, but retold. So that in his most recent book, A Child Again, we find retellings of many fairy tales, things that you heard in your childhood. A story isn't told once, it's told over and over again at different times in different forms. And so it's not surprising that when I met Robert Coover a year ago, he explained to me that he had conceived something like his entire career in one fell swoop. He knew that his first novel, The Origin of the Brunnies, would have a follow-up. He's working on it right now, these many years later. At the very beginning in his first book of stories, Prick Songs and Descants, he began experimenting with the fairy tales and formal mythologies that have informed the entirety of his work. So that at different points in his life, He's had things to say about the American Western, at one point in a play, again in a novella called Ghost Town, that heroism changes its nature and therefore changes the kind of story required to tell it in. Of course, he's hilarious. Of course, he wants to debunk the sweetness of the stories you were told the first time round. And so if I ever thought that a book could disturb and disgust me more in its textures than A Night at the Movies, it would come along as he took on pornography in The Adventures of Lucky Pierre. Reels and reels of uncut stuff. He has managed in a certain way to bring a mathematics. He understood that in retelling a story, you had to remake the structure of the story. And so he discovered, at least in American fiction, a story that kind of gets laid out like a solitaire deck. He's always busy. I know that in the lobby you'll find this book, A Child Again, and attached to it is a deck of cards. Of course, it's going to disobey me. Props always do. Let me show you. It's fabulous. These cards, once you take the first and last of them, in between you can arrange the story in any order that you like, and it will tell you what happened when the Knave of Hearts stole those tarts, and what was going on in the court, and who's allergic to tarts, and who likes to have them at bedside with a knave in bed beside her. A lot of skullduggery and magicians. By the way, Ricky Ducournay, when I first met her, told me that Robert Coover is a warlock. maybe I'll ask him what she meant by that. Maybe he doesn't know. But the excitement of watching a career evolve as a kind of spiral where the same subjects come up again and again and again. Of those writers that I mention, up to the point that William Gass's The Tunnel came out, Robert Coover was the most political of the writers involved. His book, The Public Burning, not only waited, I would say, for several years of interventions. It was the story of the Rosenbergs, and horrible Richard Nixon was shown bare-assed, I believe in Times Square, somewhere in the course of that book. Now, when I look at my copy, I noticed it says on the cover, this breaks my heart, book club edition. Imagine a book like that now being taken up by a book club. It doesn't happen anymore. Coover stays at the very front lines. He teaches electronic literature at Brown. When he lectures to school children around the country, he shows them what's happening in virtual space in the forming of fiction. At Brown, there's a cave where you can actually make a story happen, move the objects of storytelling around you as you rewrite. I love the fact that this is a man who, just a week ago, organized a conference, 27 writers, all of them were there, the older ones, the younger ones, Barth and Gass. Brown has become a home. And, you know, here he is, one of the great living exemplars of fiction as an art form and not a story of fathers and sons and abortions. I want you to welcome Robert Coover.
Actually, exemplary writers are a dime a dozen, but great readers are an incredible rarity. So we're all grateful for Michael, I can tell you. It's what I've always wanted to do, is stop teaching writing workshops, which are just sort of, dealing with competitive egos, and just teach reading workshops. where people could write, of course, as well. So I'm going to read two pieces, and hopefully they'll be within the allotted time zone. The first one is a short thing which you have somewhat of in your program. I had some doubt about reading this piece because it's in print, but I believe that it always helps to hear the author's voice behind the text. So if you leave here with only that text in hand, you'll at least have heard that much of the voice of the author. So I'm reading The Presidents. The electoral season. How delightful it is when the quadrennium is in bloom and our party-colored presidents arrive to spangle the fields and factory floors. Welcome visitants, they always are, low forms of existence though they be. The presidents are come, the children cry, and rush out to be hugged and kissed and have their photos taken with these singular creatures, half blind yet sensitive to the least hoot and twitter, elusive yet omnipresent, and even when repulsive, endowed with such curious instincts and so diverse in form and structure as to attract the attention of the most jaded observer, even if only in self-defense. The presidents are come. Yes, it sends a thrill through the heart, whether of pleasure or of apprehension, to see, after the long, dry years of stagnation and dormancy, the first one of the season sailing in on broad, sylphic pinions in the cool, slanted beams of a calm autumn morning, or else traversing the surface of the earth by those remarkable leaps and wriggles for which they are renowned. Some are gloriously bedizened, others naked but for a film of gelatinous flesh, so tightly stretched as to be reduced to an invisible tenuity. Still others are soft, plump, pale or woolly, or else a livid gray-green with hideous tail pustules, or tender, white, and tantalizingly delicate. And there are many, more familiar to the electorate, perhaps, which are actually capable of altering their external shape and changing their spots and colors even as they busily slither, flutter, and honk. While it is true that the common consent of mankind regards most of these creatures with revulsion and abhorrence, and not without reason, inasmuch as many of them are more or less noxious, and some of them are terribly fatal to their fellows, monstrosities by excess are not uncommon, being rapacious and vindictive, treacherous and cruel, even to their own kind, full of stratagem and artifice, highly venomous, lurking in darkness, endowed with curious instincts, feeding off excreta, and furnished with many accessory means for the capture and destruction of their opponents. It must nevertheless be remembered always that even these vile creatures are the handiwork of infinite wisdom and so worthy of our admiration, however distant and guarded our scrutiny must, for our own safety, be. Such scrutiny is invariably rewarded, for the presidents are curious beings in many respects. Though more or less inactive for most of their lives, they are nevertheless very enduring. They respire little, are susceptible of hibernation, and can remain for a considerable time shut up in confinement so restricted as to produce astonishment. In their movements, they are lazy and half torpid, and yet are capable of sudden gestures, short and jerky, and all too often lethal, even when perhaps not so meant. When not frightened or running for election or both, they slowly crawl along with their tails and bellies dragging on the ground. They often stop and doze for a moment with closed eyes and hind legs spread out. Many of these creatures bear highly curious appendages that resemble trumpets in form, and they emit incessant chattering sounds which simulate speech, but which are mostly imitations of the cries of other species. When they take an antipathy to anyone, they immediately show it. They suffer no rivals to approach them, but harass them ceaselessly, emitting rank screens of smoke and tearing from them the ballots that are their very sustenance. When a president has glutted itself, its crop, swelled by the votes which it has received, forms a voluminous projection in front of the neck. A fetid humor oozes from its nostrils, and it remains sunk in a state of stupid torpor until the electoral outcome is finally determined, generally at the far end of the alimentary canal. If we were asked where throughout the world specimens were to be met with, we might reply almost everywhere, provided only that voters, a necessary nutrient, be present. But even when such prey is scarce, presidents have been detected and have, moreover, in their various mutations, thrived. Darwin, in his famous voyage on the Beagle, was much struck by the curious phenomena of distribution and survival which that voyage brought before his eyes, remarking that while some classes die out as civilization spreads, others, like the rats, the common sparrow, the presidents, the cockroaches, some parasites, and so on, adjust themselves to the altered conditions and prosper under civilization as they never did in former days. Warm and temperate regions with abundant moisture are the localities favorable to all the presidents. They're said to live chiefly in ditches, especially those where stagnant and corrupt water has lain a long time, but they're also found in dung heaps, caves, swamps, and other obscure and fetid locations, choosing secret places wherein to store up all that tempts their cupidity or excites their covetousness, whether in or out of the zoo. Certainly, wherever else they might be found, they are nowhere more abundant than in America, civilization's gem and nature's pride, as is widely acknowledged, especially by the gabbling and squawking presidents themselves and by their keepers. In America, presidents find a natural habitat, abundant in provender and mud, and congenial to their notorious reproductive habits. They are not, here at least, an endangered species. Indeed, well over 50 families or subspecies have been recorded, and it is probable that they are even much more numerous than this, as new discoveries are constantly rewarding the close examination of any particular locality with each new presidential season. The prickly candescent wind-up and comatose presidents are, for example, well known, as are the inflatable president, sometimes referred to erroneously as the bouncing president, the savage blue-balled president, the infamously deviant quincuncial or conical president, and the nocturnal three-legged oblique president with its heavily lidded eyes and skin resembling inconsistent wetted parchment. Most readers would also recognize the common abominable president, the immaculate or two-humped president, the cave-dwelling abstract president, distinguishable by its multiple stomachs, contractile bladder, and abyssal eyes, which tend to disappear in thick, scaly flesh folds, and the once famous flesh-colored president from those legendary times when specimens were still found in the wild, or only later tamed in the National Zoo and then let loose to reproduce. Now, most presidents, of course, are zoo-born, of stocks bred in captivity, and either spend their freed lives in the circus or are kept as domesticated house pets and fed on perks and taxes. The possibly mythical flesh-colored presidents were said to have given birth to the homuncular, beggar tick, and revolving presidents, as well as to have sired the predaceous, boundless presidents, also known as the join-the-dots presidents because of their tendency to lose their outline to their immediate surroundings. It was this asexual yet fecund family of boundless presidents in its various evolutionary permutations that gave rise in our own times not only to the mechanical abridged or bedside montage and cartoon presidents, but also to the proliferation of multinational gathering and feeding stations or into intergalactic sporogenesis. None of this, however, has altered for the better their reputation. It's not clear why presidents should have been considered from the earliest ages as the symbol of stupidity and venality and branded with a stigma of infamy which will always cast an odium on their name.
Many, to be sure, are by nature of a despotic and combative temperament, irascible and quarrelsome, living by plunder and bloodshedding, destruction the sole object of their existence. But the innocent, which arguably outnumber the noxious and are merely ridiculous, share the disrepute and are unjustly visited with a hatred and aversion due to their malefic fellows. Nor is this popular prejudice against the entire species moderated, alas, by any evidence of natural grace and beauty. It's difficult to comprehend why nature, while it has been so kind to the related families of athletes, gigolos, and starlets, has stamped the presidents with so ungainly a form. For most families of presidents, it must be said, are homely creatures, their physiognomy at once disproportionate and peculiarly threatening, and from their low facial angle, they do have a singularly witless appearance, making them objects of a general repugnance and causing evil properties to be attributed to them. But these much despised beings are surely not so universally stupid or voracious as they are commonly said to be. In the present day, it is really time to have done with all these time-worn rhetorical fancies, which are in continual and complete variance with the results of science and observation, and to cry with the children, "The presidents are come! Hooray! Don't get too close, but long live the presidents!" Well, as Michael said there, the stories of this particular volume, my other story volumes are not like this, and although I have worked with characters like Pinocchio and Briar Rose and Stepmother in book form, this book came about because I had over the years collected a few stories that had to do with children's themes as well as children's stories, things about being a child. And wanted to group them into one single volume. And this story is based on the Pied Piper of Hamelin story, which I hope everyone's aware of. It's called The Return of the Dark Children. When the first black rats reappeared, scurrying shadowily along the river's edge and through the back alleyways, many thought the missing children would soon follow. Some believed the rats might be the children under a spell, so they were not at first killed, but were fed and pampered, not so much out of parental affection as out of fear. For many legends had grown up around the lost generation of children, siphoned from the town by the piper so many years ago. Some thought that the children had, like the rats, been drowned by the piper, and that they now returned from time to time to haunt the town that would not, for parsimony, pay their ransom. So others believed that the children had been bewitched, transformed into elves or werewolves or a kind of living dead. When the wife of one of the town councillors hanged herself, it was rumored it was because she'd been made pregnant by her own small son, appearing to her one night in her sleep as a toothless, hollow-eyed incubus. Indeed, all deaths, even those by the most natural of causes, were treated by the citizenry with suspicion. For what could be a more likely cause of a heart attack or malfunction of the inner organs than an encounter with one's child as a member of the living dead? At first, such sinister speculations were rare, heard only among the resentful childless. When the itinerant rat killer seduced the youngsters away that day with his demonic flute, all the other townsfolk could think about was rescue and revenge. Mothers wept and cried out the names of their children, calling them back, while fathers and grandfathers armed themselves and rushed off into the hills, chasing trills and echoes of trills. But nothing more substantial was ever found, not even a scrap of clothing or a dropped toy. It was as though they had never been. And as the weeks became months and the months years, hope faded and turned to resentment, so much love misspent, and then eventually to dread. New children, meanwhile, were born, replacing the old. It was indeed a time of great fertility, for there was a vacuum to be filled. And as these new children grew, a soberer generation than that which preceded it, there was no longer any place in homes or hearts for the old ones, nor for their lightsome ways. The new children were, like their predecessors and their elders, plump and happy, much loved, well-fed, and overly indulged in all things, but they were more closely watched, and there was no singing or dancing. The piper had instilled in the townsfolk a terror of all music, and it was banned forever by decree. All musical instruments had been destroyed. Humming a tune in public was an imprisonable offense, and children, rarely spanked, were spanked for it. Always it was associated with the children who had left and the chilling, ungrateful manner of their leaving. They did not even look back. But it was as though they had not really quite gone away after all, for as the new children came along, the old ones seemed to return as omnipresent shadows of the new ones, clouding the nursery and playground, stifling laughter and spoiling play. And they became known then, the lost ones, the shadowy ones, as the dark children. In time, all ills were blamed on them. If an animal sickened and died, if milk soured or a house burned, if a child woke screaming from a nightmare, if the river overflowed its banks, if money went missing from the till, or the beer went flat, or one's appetite fell off, it was always the curse of the dark children. The new children were warned, "Be good, or the dark children will get you." Well, they were not always good, and sometimes, as it seemed, the dark children did get them. And now, the newest menace, the return of the rats. The diffident pampering of these rapacious creatures soon ceased. As they multiplied, disease broke out as it had so many years before. The promenade alongside the river that ran through the town, once so popular, now is utterly forsaken, except for the infestation of rats, the flower gardens lining the promenade trampled by their little feet and left filthy and untended. For those who loitered there ran the risk of being eaten alive, as happened to the occasional pet gone astray. Their little pellets were everywhere and in everything, even in one's shoes and bed and tobacco tin. Once again, the city fathers gathered in emergency council and declared their determination to exterminate the rats, whether they were bewitched dark children or not. And once again, the rats proved too much for them. They were hunted down with guns and poisons and burned in mountainous heaps, their sour ashes blanketing the town, graying the laundry and spoiling the sauces. But their numbers seemed not to diminish. If anything, there were more of them than ever seen before, and they just kept coming. But when one rash counselor joked that it was maybe time to pay the piper, he was beaten and hounded out of town. For if the dark children were a curse upon the town, they were still their own, whereas the sorcerer who had lured them away had been like a mysterious force from another world, a diabolical intruder who had forever disturbed the peace of the little community. It was not something to laugh about. The piper, lean and swarthy, had been dressed patchily in too many colors, wore chains and bracelets and earrings, painted his bony face with ghoulish designs, smiled too much and too wickedly, and with teeth too white. His language, not of this town, was blunt and uncivil, and seemed to come not from his throat, but from some hollow place inside. Some seemed to remember that he had no eyes, others that he did have eyes, but that the pupils were golden. He ate sparely, if at all, some claimed to have seen him nibbling at the rats, and most telling of all, he was never seen to relieve himself. All this in retrospect, of course, for at the time, the townsfolk, vastly comforted by the swift and entertaining eradication of the rats, saw him as merely an amusing street musician to be tolerated and, if not paid all that he impertinently demanded, there had been nothing illegal about this, no contracts had been signed, at least applauded, the elders, like the children, in short, fatally beguiled by the fiend. No, should he return, he would be attacked by all means available, and if possible, torn apart limb from limb, his flute rammed down his throat, the plague of rats be damned. He who placed himself beyond the law would be spared by none. Left to their own resources, however, the townsfolk were no match for the rats. For all their heroic dedication, the vermin continued to multiply, the disease spread and grew more virulent, and the sky darkened with the sickening ash, now no longer of rats only, but sometimes of one's neighbors as well, and now and then a child or two. Having lost one generation of children, the citizenry were determined not to lose another, and did all they could to protect the children, their own and others, not only from the rats, but also from the rumored dark children. For there had been reported sightings of late, mostly by night, of strange naked creatures with piebald flesh moving on all fours through the hills around. They had the form of children, those who claimed to have seen them said, but they were not children. Some said they had gray, fleshy wings and could hover and fly with the darting speed of a dragonfly. Parents now boiled their children's food and sterilized their drink, policed their bedrooms and bathrooms and classrooms, never let them for a single minute be alone. Even so, now and then, one of them would disappear, spreading fear and consternation throughout the town. But now, when a child vanished, no search parties went out looking for it as they'd done the first time, for the child was known to be gone as were the dead gone, all children gone or perished, spoken of not as dead, but taken. The city elders, meeting in continuous emergency session, debated the building of an impregnable wall around the town to keep the dark children out and hopefully to dam the tide of invading rats as well. This had a certain popular appeal, especially among the parents, but objections were raised. If every able-bodied person in town worked day and night at this task, it was argued, it would still take so long that the children might all be gone before it could be finished. Then they'd just be walling themselves in with the rats. And who knew what made a wall impregnable to the likes of the dark children? Weren't they, if they really existed, more like phantoms than real creatures, for whom brick and stone were no obstruction? Moreover, the building of such a wall would drain the town of all its energy and resources and close it off to trade. It would be the end of the era of prosperity, if what they were suffering now could still be called prosperity. And not only the children could be lost, but also the battle against the rats, which was already proving very taxing for the community. But what else can we do? We must be more vigilant. And so special volunteer units were created to maintain a 24-hour watch on all children. The playgrounds were walled off and sealed with double locks, a compromise with the proponents of the wall building, and all the children's spaces were kept brightly lit to chase away the shadows, even as they slept at night. Shadows that seemed to move by themselves were shot at. Some observed that whenever a child disappeared, a pipe could be heard faintly just before. Well, whether this was true or not, all rumors of such flaunting of the music laws were pursued with full vigor. And after many false alarms, one piper was at last chased down, a little boy of 6, one of the new children, blowing on a wooden recorder. He was a charming and dutiful boy, much loved by all, but he had to be treated as the demon he now was, and so, like any diseased animal, he and his pipe were destroyed. His distraught parents admitted to having hidden away the childish recorder as a souvenir at the time of outlawing musical instruments, and the child somehow inexplicably found it. The judges did not think it was inexplicable. There were calls for the death penalty, but the city fathers were not cruel or vindictive and understood that the parents had been severely punished by the loss of their child, so they were given lengthy prison sentences instead. No one protested. the prison itself was now so rat-infested that even short sentences amounted to the death penalty anyway. The dark children now were everywhere, or seemed to be. If the reports of the frightened citizenry were to be believed, the hills about now swarmed with the little bat-like phantoms, and there was daily evidence of their presence in the town itself. Pantries were raided, flour spilled, eggs broken. There was salt in the sugar, urine in the teapot, obscene scribblings on the school chalkboard and on the doors of closed shops whose owners had taken ill or died. Weary parents returned from work and rat hunting to find all the pictures on their walls tipped at odd angles, bird cages opened, door handles missing. That these sometimes turned out to be the pranks of their own mischievous children was not reassuring, for one had to assume they'd fallen under the spell of the dark children, something they could not even tell anyone about for fear of losing their children to the severity of the laws of vigilance now in place. Whenever they attempted to punish them, the children would cry out, "It's not my fault. The dark children made me do it." "All right, all right. But shush now. No talk of that." There were terrible accidents, which were not accidents. A man socializing with friends left the bar one night to return home and made a wrong turn, stumbled instead into the ruined gardens along the promenade. One who had seen him passing by said it was as if his arm were being tugged by someone or something unseen, and he looked stricken with terror. His raw carcass was found the next morning at the edge of the river. One rat hunter vanished as though consumed entirely, and another was shot dead by a fellow hunter. And in two different cases, rat poison, though kept under lock and key, turned up in food. In both instances, a spouse died, but the partners were miraculously spared. When asked if the killing was an accident, the hunter who had shot his companion said it certainly was not. A mysterious force had gripped his rifle barrel and moved it just as he was firing it. And things didn't seem to be where they once were anymore, especially at night. Furniture slid about and knocked one over. Walls seemed to swing out and strike one. Stair steps dropped away halfway down. Of course, people were drinking a lot more than usual. Reports may have been exaggerated, but once reliable certainties were dissolving. The dark children remained largely invisible for all that the town felt itself swarming with them, though some people claimed to have seen them running with the rats, swinging on the belfry rope, squatting behind chimney pots on rooftops. And with each reported sighting, they acquired new features. They were said to be child-sized, but adult in proportions, with long arms they sometimes used while running. They could scramble up walls and hug the ground and disappear right into it. They were gaudily colored and often had luminous eyes. Wings were frequently mentioned, and occasionally tails. Sometimes these were short and furry, other times more long and rat-like. Money from the town treasury disappeared, and one of the counselors as well. And his wife, though hysterical with grief and terror, was able to describe in startling detail the bizarre horned and winged creatures who came to rob the town and carry him off. "Ah, we didn't know they had horns. Oh, yes, with little rings on the tips or bells. They were glittery all over as if dressed in jewels." She said she was certain that one of them was her own missing son, stolen away by the piper all those many years ago. "I looked into his eyes and pleaded with him not to take his poor father away," she wept, "but his eyes had no pupils, only tiny flickering flames where the pupils should be." They asked her to write out a complete profile of the dark children, but then she disappeared too. When one of the volunteer guards watching children was charged with fondling a little 5-year-old girl, he insisted that no, she was being sexually assaulted by one of the dark children, and he was only doing all he could to get the hellish creature off her. The child was confused, but seemed to agree with this. "But what about what happened to the dark child?" "I don't know. The little girl screamed. A crowd came running. The dark child faded away in my grasp. All I managed to hold on to was this," he said, holding up a small gold earring. "A common ornament. Most children wear them and lose them daily. I tore it out of his nose," he said. He was found innocent, but removed from the unit and put on probation. In his affidavit, he also mentioned horns and was able to provide a rough sketch of the dark child's genitalia, which resembled those of a goat. The new children pretended not to see the dark children, or perhaps in their innocence, they did not see them, yet overheard conversations among them suggested they knew more than they were telling, and when they were silent, they sometimes seemed to be listening intently, smiling faintly. The dark children turned up in their rope-skipping rhymes and childish riddles. When is water not wet? When a dark child's shadow makes it. And when they chose up sides for games of ball or tag, they tended always to call one of their teams the dark children. The other was usually the hunters. The small children cried if they couldn't be on the dark children's team. When a child was taken, his or her name was whispered among the children like a kind of incantation, which they said was for good luck. The church organist, unemployed since the piper went through and reduced to grave tending, a task that had somewhat maddened him, retained enough presence of mind to notice that the familiar racket of the children's playground games, though still composed of the usual running feet and high-pitched squealing, was beginning to evolve into a peculiar musical pattern, reminiscent of the piper's songs. He transcribed some of this onto paper, which was studied in private chambers by the city council, where for the first time in many years, surreptitious humming was heard. And at home, in their rooms, when the children played with their dolls and soldiers and toy castles, the dark children, with their mysterious ways, now always played a part in their little dramas. One could hear them talking to the dark children speaking back in funny, squeaky voices that quavered like a ghost's. Even if it was entirely invented, an imaginary world made out of scraps overheard from parents and teachers, it was the world they chose to live in now, rather than the one provided by their loving families, which was, their parents often felt, a kind of betrayal, lack of gratitude, lost trust, and, well, just not fair. One day, one of the rat hunters, leaning on his rifle after a long day's work and smoking his old black pipe, peered down into the infested river and allowed that it seemed to him that whenever a child disappeared or died, the rat population decreased. Those with him stared down into that same river and wondered, was this possible? A rat census was out of the question, but certain patterns in their movements could be monitored. There was a wooden footbridge, for example, which the rats used for crossing back and forth or just cavorting on, and one could at any moment make a rough count of the rats on it. At the urging of the hunters, these tabulations were taken by the town clerk at dawn, midday, and twilight for several days, and the figures were found to be quite similar from day to day, no matter how many were killed. Then a little girl failed to return from a game of hide-and-seek. The law banning this game, or any game having to do with concealment, was passing through the chambers that very day. And the next day, the rat numbers were found to have dropped. Well, not substantially, perhaps. One would not have noticed the change at a glance, but it was enough to make the bridge count mandatory by law. A child chasing a runaway puppy fell into the turbulent river and was taken, and the numbers dropped again then, or about then. Likewise, when another child disappeared, he left a note saying he was going where the dark children were to ask if they could all be friends, and a fourth died from the diseases brought by the rats. Another emergency session of the council was called, which all adult members of the community were invited to attend. No one stayed away. The choice before them was stark, but being all but unthinkable, was not at first enunciated. The parents, everyone knew, were adamant in not wanting it spoken aloud at all. There were lengthy prolegomena outlining the history of the troubles from the time of the piper's visit to the present, including reports from the health and hospital services, captains of the rat hunting teams, the business community, the volunteer vigilance units, school and toilet monitors, the town clerk, and artists who provided composite sketches of the dark children based on reported sightings. They did not look all that much like children of any kind, but that was to be expected. A mathematician was brought in to explain in precise technical detail the ratio between the disappearance or death of children and the decrease in the rat population. He was convincing, though not well understood. Someone suggested a break for tea, but this was voted down. There was a brief flurry of heated discussion when a few parents expressed their doubts as to the dark children's actual existence, suggesting they might merely be the fantasy of an understandably hysterical community. This argument rose and faded quickly, as it had few adherents. Finally, there was nothing to do but confront it. Their choice was between letting the children go or living and dying with the rats. Of course, it was unconscionable that the children should be sacrificed to save their elders, or even one another. That was the opinion vehemently expressed by parents, teachers, clergy, and many of the other ordinary townfolk. This was not a decision one could make for others, and the children were not yet of an age to make it for themselves. The elders nodded solemnly. All had to acknowledge the rightness of this view. Furthermore, the outcome, based on speculative projections from these preliminary observations, was just too uncertain, the admirable mathematics notwithstanding, for measures so merciless and irreversible. A more thorough study was required. As for the bridge counts themselves, seasonal weather changes were proposed as a more likely explanation of the decline in rat population, if in fact there had been such a decline. The numbers themselves were disputed, and alternative, unofficial, less decisive tabulations made by others, worried parents mostly, were presented to the assembly and duly considered. And even if the official accounts were true, a teacher at the school argued, the vermin population was probably decreasing normally, for all such plagues have their tides and ebbs. With patience, it will all be over. The data, however, did not support this view. Even those sympathetic with them understood that the parents and teachers were not trying to engage in a reasoned search for truth, but were desperately seeking to persuade. The simple facts were that the town was slowly dying from the infestation of rats, and whenever a child was taken, the infestation diminished. Everyone knew this, even the parents. The data was admittedly sketchy, but time was short. A prolonged study might be a fatal misjudgment. A doctor described in uncompromising detail the current crisis in the hospitals, their staffs disease-riddled, patients sleeping on floors, medications depleted, the buildings themselves a swarm with rats, and the hunters reminded the assembly that their own untiring efforts had not been enough alone to get the upper hand against the beasts, though many of them were parents, too, and clearly ambivalent about their testimony. Those who had lost family members to the sickness and risked losing more, their own lives included, spoke bluntly. If the children stay, they will all die of the plague like the rest of us, so it's not as though we would be sacrificing them to a fate worse than they would suffer here. But if they go, some of us might be saved. A compromise was proposed. Lots could be drawn, and the children could be released one by one until the rats disappeared. That way, some might be spared. But that would not be fair, others argued, for why should some parents be deprived of their children when others were not? Wouldn't that divide the community irreparably forever? In any way, the question might be purely academic. Everyone had noticed during the mathematician's presentation the disconcerting relationship between the rate of decrease of the rat population and the number of children remaining in the town. They want the children, shouted a fierce old man from the back of the hall. So let them have them. We can always make more. Pandemonium broke out, shouts and accusations. You think it's so easy, cried one. Where are your own? It's not the making, cried others. It's the raising. They were shouted down and they shouted back. People were called murderers and cowards and egoists, ghouls and nihilists. Parents screamed that if their children had to die, they would die with them, and their neighbors yelled, good riddance. Through it all, there was a steady pounding of the gavel, and finally, when order was restored, the oldest member of the council, who was also judged to be the wisest, silent until now, was asked to give his opinion. His chair was wheeled to the illumined center of the little platform at the front of the hall, whereon behind him the elders sat. He gazed out upon the muttering crowd, his old hands trembling, but his expression calm and benign, and slowly a hush descended. "There is nothing we can do," he said at last in his feeble old voice. "It is the revenge of the Dark Children. Years ago, we committed a terrible wrong against them, and this is their justified reply." He paused, sitting motionlessly in the pale light. "We thought that we could simply replace them," he said, "but we were wrong." He seemed to be dribbling slightly, and he raised one trembling hand to wipe his mouth. "I do not know if the Dark Children really exist," he went on. "I myself have never seen them. But even if they do not, it is the revenge of the Dark Children just the same." He paused again as if wanting his words to be thoroughly understood before proceeding, or perhaps because his thoughts came slowly to him. "I have, however, seen the rats, and even with my failing eyesight, I know that they are real. I also know that the counting of them is real, whether accurate or not, and that your responses to this counting, while contradictory, are also real. Perhaps they are the most real thing of all." He seemed to go adrift for a moment, his head nodding slightly, before continuing, "It may be that the diminishing number of rats is due to the day-by-day loss of our children, or it may be due to nature's rhythms, or to the weather, or to the success at last of our hunters. It may even be that the numbers are not diminishing, that we are mistaken. It does not matter. The children must go." There was a soft gasp throughout the hall. "Because," he said as the gasp died away, "we are who we are." The old man gazed out at them for a short time, and each felt singled out, though it was unlikely he could see past the edge of the platform. "The children will not go one by one," he went on. "They will all go at once and immediately. That is both fair and practical, and, I might add, inevitable." He nodded his head as though agreeing with himself, or perhaps for emphasis. "They themselves will be happier together than alone. And if we who remain cannot avoid grief, we can at least share it and comfort one another. Even now, if our humble suggestions are being followed, the children are being gathered together and told to put on their favorite clothes and bring their favorite toys, and they are being brought to the town square outside this building." As parents, turning pale, rose slowly from their seats, he again wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, and his expression took on a more sorrowful aspect. "I foresee a rather sad future for our town," he said. "The rats will finally disappear for whatever reason, though others of us will yet perish of their loathsome diseases, and our promenade will reopen and trade will resume. Even should we repeal the music laws, however, there will still be little, if any, singing or dancing here, for there will be no children, only the memory of children. It has not been easy for the town's mothers and fathers to suffer so twice over, and I feel sorry for them, as I am sure we all do. We must not ask them to go through all that again." He cocked his old head slightly. "Ah, I can hear the children outside now. They're being told they're going off to play with the Dark Children. They will leave happily. You will all have an opportunity to wave goodbye, but they will probably not even look back. Nor, of course, will they ever return." In the shocked pause before the rush to the exits, he added, speaking up slightly, "And now will we at last be free of the Dark Children?" He sighed, and as his head dipped to his chest, raised one trembling finger, wagging it slowly, as though in solemn admonishment, "No, no, my friends, we will not." Thank you.
concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Robert Coover will be signing books in the lobby at the end of the reading, and I hope if he is a new writer to you, you will explore what he's done. Now, this is a very frightening story, yes? I wanted to begin by acknowledging...
Oh, I love this.
how many times the story of the Pied Piper has been told. There's a Robert Browning poem. I believe there's a symphony of prancing and sprightly music to accompany the Merry Piper leading the children away from the town. But now, it's not just that the story is being retold. The children are leaving yet again. So the re-leaving and returning becomes a part of the retelling of the tale. Where did you first encounter the Pied Piper?
Oh, as a child. Yeah. And I didn't think of it. I thought, I suppose, all along of it as a sort of scary story. But this, the because, you know, taking the children away, as German stories often tend to be. But I also was thinking of another kind of scariness when I started working with this piece, as you can see through the lines of it, of the town itself, and the disease that strikes it when it develops an irrational fear.
And that second kind of fear, tell about it.
Well, it's the fear that, in, for example, passes through the public Brüning, or passes through the Brünists, and both fore and aft. I mean, both the old one and the new one. And it is that terror that emerges when one surrenders to something irrational, to the notion of something that in the public Brüning, it's the phantom, you might say. So there is something in common with all of these texts which invoke or evoke the scariness of the community when it loses its mind. I wrote a cowboy play, for example, called The Kid, some 30 years ago, which had to do with that same keeping the community together by some sort of irrational and terrifying means, really. And the innocence, above all, had to be destroyed in order to make that possible.
Now, the usual story of casting out the scapegoat is for the health of the community, and Greek tragedy suggests that when we get rid of the man who caused the plague to come, Oedipus, that the plague will be, in fact, relieved. These stories suggest that as we tell over and over and over again the story of the plague relieved by expunging the scapegoat, that we leave instead the sickness of the community. In other words, that tragedy in some way no longer works, and that even the ritual hounding of the other, the proclaimed other, that this is no longer a successful means, and yet it is a repeated means by which a community invents itself and its myths.
Yes, well, I would agree with all that. I wouldn't have much to add to it. You might say that any mythological structure meant to hold a community intact will have elements of madness in it that can become warped and create the kind of terrors that arise when that happens. It's sort of difficult for any community to sustain itself without something quasi-mythical holding it together is sort of, you know, if it might be the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution or some sort of structure that you adhere to, more or less rational are the structure, the elements may seem rational when read, but not always when defended. And to do without these things altogether makes it difficult for any community to hold together at all, if that's what we want people to do, hold together in communities. But any threat to that, any danger that would might be perceived or honked about by the leaders is apt to generate then an irrational fear that is attaching itself to something that is not itself exactly real. It is a myth. And so one finds oneself being a patriot or a Christian, etc., but not in terms of any kind of rational approach to these things, but rather a very irrational defending of something that seems to be threatened.
One of the things that fascinates me when I'm reading you is that while the structures that allow for the growth and conflagration of the irrational in a community are part of the subject of the story, fiction at the same time is seen itself to carry irrational powers, almost as if in the course of knowing the structure of story and the structure of how society decays, the storyteller becomes something of a wizard. When you read Robert Coover's work, you'll see there's a certain level at which a hysteria of invention enters. It becomes incantatory. You find the fiction itself taking on powers of almost preservation. The public burning itself, while it's watching a literal electrocution, crucifixion at the center, televised, it's invoking all kinds of past moments in which almost demonic entertainments have delighted the American people. Coon shows and minstrel shows, vaudevilles, all sorts of TV things. Fiction itself carries demonic power, and in a certain sense, you want to get the power in the right hands. It's like stealing it back from the people who actually believe in the devil to usins who believe that if we invoke the devil, we might produce instructive healings.
Okay, let me back down a little bit off these grand levels. I'm going to be caught out and burned before I get out of here. And say that of course fictions for me do rule the world in many ways. I mean, that's what we're talking about. We talk about a myth or a legend, the kinds of things that hold together a patriotic or religious community, and the story material on which people without a lot of time to think about things have to rely. So we have fairly simple little tales that are kind of raised up and have these powers over us and over our community, and that's equally true in perhaps more psychological ways, more individual ways, but in the way that the movies do it to us, or the children's stories, or the television, as you just mentioned, or any other forms of what we call entertainment, which is always a kind of invasion of the mind and imposing upon the mind a set of kind of fictional constructs. So when I first began writing, what I was thinking about, what kind of torched my desire to write in the way I do, was the notion that this was the interesting thing, that the most interesting thing about story was story itself, how it worked, and who told the stories, and what the consequences of that were. And I then, of course, looked to those stories that seemed to have the most impact and the most grip on our imaginations.
And the first one I took on was the Christian story, and the second one I made, the second one I literally took on was the American tale by way of baseball. But then the next one was the large American myth that had to do with the Cold War era, the vision of the world that was the mythic version of that time, and so on. And as I proceeded through various forms of storytelling, it's been that with that thought in mind that it's not that I'm trying to raise the devil, though perhaps I am, but rather that I'm trying to expose, re-see all these stories, take away their inappropriate powers, keep for them what might still have some value to us, even if it's only emotional and not intellectual, but not to let them dominate us in any unexamined way. So the examination of story and seeing my way through it all has been a strong motivation. Certainly it's a strong motivation in this set of stories, because I see these things that we get told as children, and that they do enter our imaginations in various ways, sometimes in ways we never questioned thereafter. And it's my fun, the thing I get out of the whole experience of being a writer, is to get inside those stories and re-see them and review them for others. And that is a kind it's certainly, if it's not diabolical, it certainly is an effort to undermine the powers that those stories have.
In speaking about this in the course, I met Coover finally. I begged one publisher after another to please send him to Los Angeles. Many would promise Simon & Schuster, Grove. It wasn't until the McSweeney's people published A Child Again that I got to talk to him. And he said one of the most unusual things I've ever heard a writer say to me. He said about one of his books, and I don't want to go into the gossip about this, he said about one of his books that it would have been a better book had there been a good editor on it. And it's very rare that I've heard a writer say such a thing. Many writers resent the intrusion of editors and the requirements that a publishing house brings to the work. But in that particular case, you were talking about a certain kind of neglect. And I'm interested in the effects that editors have had on your work.
Mostly benign, I would say. Mostly hands-off. And that's okay. And when hands-on, mostly resisted on my part. But sometimes there have been things I wanted a good reader to think about, and since I don't pass my books around to other people much except Pilar, I could use sometimes a vision of, let's say, a certain kind of orthography to think this works, or am I getting too extreme with this? Or I had one wonderful editor. The best I ever had was a young man who died young, unfortunately, who, reading the baseball book, simply asked me one question, and the question triggered the necessary thinking, and I revised the book, especially one particular chapter, thinking what he'd pointed out, a kind of little bit of a gap, a hole there. And he didn't suggest anything, he just asked the right question. So so there have been moments when it's been very positive, but the main positive thing that editors have done for me, and the reason I am grateful to many of them, is simply that against odds often, and against resistance from their own publishers, they managed to get my books into print. I mean, this was not a joke. There were several times when, if it hadn't been for a courageous editor, the books would have been dumped. Public Burning was a good example. Without Dick Seaver, that book would never have appeared. I'd have had to publish it myself at best. And young editor Alan Peacock, who was fired several times. In fact, fired each time one of my books came out. Poor man, he had to give up editing finally. He just didn't want to do that again. But people would say, we'll publish this only if you see that this, this, and this is done. And the editor, knowing that I would not do those things,
would still somehow manage to get the book out. So I've been grateful to a number of editors who have been, in that way, exceedingly helpful. Sometimes they have been really brilliant at producing a good jacket design. You know, I mean, that's sometimes kind of pleasing when something looks good and it comes out. That, this one here, I mean, this editor was not otherwise helpful, but that's just a great jacket cover. And so that's the first, those are the first lines of the book. We talked about leaving them out of the text inside, but he said, well, some people will lose that jacket. there have been negative influences, too, things that have been, I've been pressured to do and then came to regret. Not often, but once or twice. Title change. Maybe a lack of understanding of something, and I began to think, well, maybe it was wrong after all. But that's very rare. It's almost never that that's happened. And on the whole, it's either been benign neglect or a bit of courage.
Well, it's interesting because when I was young, I used to hear stories of almost legendary editors. David Siegel, I think, was one. Hal Sharlock, at Dutton's. And you would hear these stories of editors who not only found the writers who were new and interesting, but fought for them, got the books published. And then, you know, it's kind of odd because, you know, I hate to say it, books are found by people of taste, right? And at publishing houses now, they're kind of few and far between. That's not the job of an editor anymore. The job of an editor, like the job of most movie critics, has become anticipating the public tastes, not criticizing them, not educating them or raising them, but trying to jump on a bandwagon before the people on the bandwagon are tired of being jumped on, you know? I wondered, since you have gone to McSweeney's, and later in the year we'll be talking to the editors, both from McSweeney's and from Believer Books, about that experience.
It's been great. They have been superb. They have not in any way attempted to do any editing as such. They have simply been delightful publishers. They make very beautiful books. You held that one up. But also the stepmother book, which they did, kind of embossed cover and all that. It was very beautiful work. And they've been very loyal to the books and done well by them. You mentioned Hal. One of the things that Hal did, which was very unusual for writers who were not that well known, he kept the hardback, not only kept it in print for a whole year, but he continued to put in little ads in New York Review books, et cetera, for a full year. So by the time that year was over, the paperback had kind of been sent on its way. And the two books that he did like that are the only two books of mine that ever never went out of print. That was Prick Songs and Descants and the Universal Baseball Association. So these two were so well tended, so cared for, so moved along in its path, and never forgotten about, and even as it moved toward the paperback, still watching out for it, that he kind of shepherded them right into a kind of permanent continuity, which was great.
Now, along the line of stealing back the stories so they no longer use them against us, there was a period. The Universal Baseball Association is about one of those board dice baseball games, but eventually the proprietor, James Henry Waugh, who happens to have the initials Yud He Vov of Jehovah.
It's an accident, a mere accident.
A mere accident, as always. He invents the universe in the course of playing his baseball game and the Cold War and wars in general. But what amused me about this book is that it, like Bernard Malamud's The Natural, was probably popular because it was about baseball. People love baseball. It's American. And I wondered about that
Actually, it was popular because
it was about baseball board games. it's amazing. That's a whole different crowd of people out there. They pretend to like baseball, but they're really fascinated by fantasy baseball and various forms now. Of course, computer-driven ones are hugely, enormously popular. And I found a few baseball players who liked the book, who were able to read and write the book. But on the whole, these were other Henry Waugh's sitting around in quiet little places in the old days playing dice or spinners, and now, of course, using the computer. And I only discovered that they were all out there when that book came out. I thought this was kind of an eccentric little idea, and presented it and wrote it and thought, well, you know, nobody will know quite who this Henry Waugh is who would do such a thing. And then, of course, then the letters started coming in from mental institutions. I had a guy who did write and say, Jesus, now they'll know I'm not insane. This is why he was sent up for playing baseball games on his kitchen table. And, of course, that's... and then I was dogged by people who wanted me to get up a kind of community of these baseball game players. Guy who was like fourth violin in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra chased me all over the continent trying to get me to meet my responsibility, having launched this book. It was up to me now to bring all of these people together, this great community of baseball parlor game freaks. Now, it does go back, you know, baseball doesn't go back that far. You only think of latter part of the, well, Civil War forward, let's say, but it reaches its kind of big professional era right at the turn of the century when the American League and National is formed and challenges the National League, and they begin to have their World Series. And the oldest board game sent me was copyrighted 1904 and made in Japan. So, you know, that was, it's as much part of baseball as baseball itself.
But what I'm interested in is that part of telling American stories to Americans who, in a sense, need to be anesthetized by the popular story, and then what Kierkegaard says, we need to anathematize the world of the cliché, that somehow or other the books come along about these American themes that are popular elsewhere, fairy tales too, that somehow or other the writer's job is to inoculate the reader against the power of image, of unchecked American dreamism.
Yeah, well, it's true that a lot of what you do when you start out is you start out with what looks familiar and friendly, and only with time do you begin to recognize that you're being led down a different path, that the path you thought you were on was a familiar one, and it becomes unfamiliar. And it's true the baseball book as such is one that has a way of reaching audiences that don't typically read. It's a very popular book for engineering students who have to take one literature course before they can get out of it. But all the other things that I have written tend to start with a kind of, not a lure, but just a kind of setting a space in the ground that you know where you are at first, and you think you know where you are before you begin to be led into what's the story material itself.
Now, underneath the content of the story is the structure of the story, and many critics, in particular, I think your friend Jackson Cope, pointed out often a kind of mystical helix-like internal structure. Do you feel, as certainly John Barth does, that there's something irreducible in story, something that appeals because of its very internal structure?
Yes, well, Plato called it, or Aristotle called it, I guess, mythos, plot. it's the notion of that kernel of something that holds the key to everything. And that kernel always has a shape, and that shape dictates to some extent the form of the story. It's not always apparent at first glance, and so you have to enter into your metaphoric material and play with it, search it through. Sometimes it's a research issue. More often it's just a getting acquainted issue. And the deeper you get, the more you see that this piece of writing, this story that you have developing, does have in its inside itself a kind of necessary form. And that form is always varies for me. And almost none of my pieces follow the same form twice. But each one follows the notion that form is growing out of that mythos that's at the core of the piece. And once I see that, once I perceive it, sometimes I'll have written quite a bit already, then I back down and reshape and plunge forward knowing what I've got.
A final question. You've said that although you teach computer hypertext new post-page forms, that you yourself are a writer who works on the page, and that it's not your intention to go into a new medium. I wondered if you could talk about that and say why.
Well, the why is quite simple, that, he's only got so many lives to live, and what I know how to do already and what I have yet to do in that form is already, it's a minimal I've got to last at least another 40 or 50 years. And so even before I could, start this new thing, I would have to finish that work. But it doesn't mean I haven't toyed around in the space, because I've felt it to be, since the late 80s, to be the inevitable direction that we're all moving in, that is the digital revolution that has overtaken us. And that digital world, which will still include print literature, but now includes it rather than being dominated by it, is our reality. It's the world we live in, and we either join that world or live as eccentrics on the outside of it, which is also a perfectly justifiable position. But with students coming through now, young writers, I at least want them to be aware of the existence of this other sort of literature that's developing, and every day developing ever more rapidly. We began with little experiments 16 years ago, and within 3 or 4 years there were hundreds and then soon thousands of practitioners. When the internet came along, there were a lot of artists suddenly found their way into it by way of the convergence of the arts in the digital world, that music, image, text, and animation, all of these things are all using the same little atomic structures of O's and 1's that is the digital world. And so there's a necessity to think of all these at once now when you're creating artworks, whether they're musical works or literary works. And so being aware of that, at least, even if they want to back away and write on paper, that's okay, but not to be ignorant of it. And so our fun has been really the pedagogical fun of what's new, what else can we do here? And that's why we've kind of branched out now into the spatial hypertext that we're developing inside immersive virtual reality, and which is, all of this new work tends to be interactive, but doesn't have to be. We have pieces that just roll over you like a train running over you. And
is that pleasant?
Yeah. Well, when it's only light, it's not bad. But it can be scary. I've had people scream and back out of the cave as it starts to happen to them. The cave is the kind of little acronym for this space. These little rooms that are creative. It's a recursive one, because I think that the AVE stands for audio, or probably advanced visual, not exploration, I forget the
experimentation?
Name. Experimentation, I don't know. But anyway, C stands for cave, so it's the cave. Cave was too nice a word to not to use, and the people who invented it were not writers and could not think of any words that began with C. So,
well, those of us who can think of words that begin with C, like Coover, will be lining up to thank Robert Coover for his reading this evening. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.